Public Radio. I'm Mark Glassman. Our guests today are Gary B. Nash, Assistant Professor at UCLA, and Charlotte Crabtree, a Professor of Curriculum Studies at UCLA. Welcome, both of you, to Book Radio.
Thank you, Mark. Good to be here.
In order to assuage the feelings of any of your critics who may be listening to this program, I thought I would mention, at least in passing, three important figures in American history, starting with George Washington, who was a white male slave-owning hemp grower, Thomas Edison, who was a white male monopolist who attempted to control both the electric power industry and the motion picture industry, and John D. Rockefeller, a white male creator of modern oil industry, whose great-granddaughter, in my personal experience, was known to have a poster of a North Vietnamese woman soldier on her door at Radcliffe as her expression of her opposition to a war in Vietnam, which I think I can safely say she believed was a genocidal assault on the indigenous people of that area. So much for white males. Gary B. Nash and Charlotte Crabtree are both the authors and characters in this book. Could you tell us whether it was difficult, easy, fun, or whether there were any special requirements to writing a history book that had yourselves as characters?
That is a new experience for me, Mark. I've never tried autobiography. I've written about the past. I never wrote about the present. So I'm a 17th, 18th century historian, looking backward 200 years perspective. On the other hand, that to say, it was very therapeutic, given the trench warfare we found ourselves in, trying to sort it out for ourselves and then rise above the level of the trenches just a bit to get greater leverage on it and try to explain to the public, to parents and readers in general, how this controversy was connected to controversies going all the way back to the way the American Revolution was interpreted almost from the day it was over.
Was your idea when you got into curriculum development as a profession that you would someday be a public figure who would have to defend your work in the Senate and on national television?
Well, because my field has been the field of social studies education, I guess I had a certain resilience for what was coming, simply because the field of social studies has always been a controversial field.
Give us a little bit of an example. The first part of your book is full of those, of talking about the opposition to various approaches to history teaching, yes, that have been occurring from the beginning of the country. Uh-huh. Give us a little bit of an example and a flavor of that.
Well, I'll let Gary speak to the warfare over which history and whose history. This is a field he's better qualified to deal with. But the social studies field itself, which is the larger vessel in which history has been taught over the past 60 years or so. Prior to that, history was the queen of the field.
Right.
And for a variety of historical reasons, it began to fall out of favor and a more presentist orientation took its place.
Right.
We've had a long history of censorship over the content of the textbooks that children shall read, and these have flared up regularly throughout the 20th century.
Well, what's been the dynamic with that? Who's sort of been in favor of what have the different points of view been, and who's been supporting them and opposing them?
Well, I don't want to over-stereotype
right.
this, but in times of stress, of national confrontation and turmoil, whether it's a period of war, or a period of recession, or a period of general public distrust and malaise, it has tended to be a war between those who want to go back to something safe that they believe they studied at one time, that celebrates the good and the true and the beautiful,
right,
and become very, very upset with any content which asks students to think.
Right.
To analyze, to take alternative positions, to understand at a deeper level than just to list facts and memorize and believe.
Not to stereotype again, but it's sort of a thinking versus believing dichotomy is what
Absolutely.
It's been. Okay, right. Tell us just a little bit more, before we move on to the controversy that's at the center of the book, about the history of that and how people like Charles Beard, for example, who said that there were economic interests at work in the creation of the Constitution and not just some sort of idealized acting of something in history versus the people who felt that it was inappropriate to to tell people that?
I think a lot goes back to old arguments, and we're hearing them today, about how history should be used to mold the good citizen.
Right.
Here are these young people starting to read some history, maybe when they're 9 or 10 years old.
Right.
And how are we going to use history as a way of bringing out in them, schooling them up to be the model citizen? And there's where we have an interesting argument. I think historians believe that they'll be better citizens if they learn about tragedy as well as triumph in our past or in any society's past, where there's another school of thought that will just lead kids to think, gosh, I don't even want to live in this country if it did all these terrible things to Indians and then was deeply involved in slavery, this brutalizing institution. So we don't need kids learning that. Maybe when they get to college, that's time enough. In the meantime, we need the civic lessons, which are ennobling and inspiriting and glorify the nation.
No one seems to think other than that schools should prepare students to be good citizens. It's that the different groups have different views of what a good citizen is.
Yes.
And different groups have different understandings of when students are mature enough to tackle issues that are not simply right and wrong, black and white, true or false.
Right.
But people who carefully studied the history standards from the kindergarten through the 12th grade would have realized is that the early years, the kindergarten through grade 4, was far more celebratory, based upon Bruno Bettelheim's belief that with young children you want to teach them to love the country first, before you expose its problems, then they're ready to devote themselves to solving the problems.
Right.
But to keep that formula going right to the 12th grade,
right,
underestimates the children today, what the high schoolers are only too well aware of in their own lives, and what intellectually they're quite capable of doing.
I'd like to talk about this issue philosophically in general longer, but I think we need to move on to the specific issue, and I think we're going to come back to the philosophical level after we see the facts of the case. So we'll use our critical thinking skills and our fact-finding skills both to pursue this issue. How did it come to pass that George Bush established a commission on national history standards?
Well, he didn't.
Oh, he didn't? Okay.
But he led the administration's role,
right,
in getting involved in the setting of national standards. It was the governors who started this,
okay,
whole thing.
Yeah, Bill Clinton.
The National Governors Association, of which Bill Clinton was co-chairman.
All right, and this led to the creation of the Standards Committee. How did you come to be involved with it, both of you?
Well, the Congress had established a National Commission for Standards and Testing, or some such name.
Right.
And they were going to look into the feasibility to advise Congress. Meanwhile, the science people and all their various organizations were off and running.
Right.
Math had already done it.
Right.
And we were approached by Diane Ravitch in the Department of Education to submit a proposal that we assemble all the parties who would be legitimately involved in this as co-directors of the National History Center at that time. And we submitted such a proposal, actually, to the National Endowment for the Humanities and Lynn Cheney, and were awarded the funding to do this, contingent upon our being able to bring in all of the major organizations, and we did.
A little less than $1 million off you, right, for the whole project? Two grants?
There were a series of supplemental grants,
right,
beyond.
It was around the level of $1 million for the project, you see. Okay. How did you get it specifically involved, and what was your responsibility in all this?
I'd been working with Charlotte. She invited me to work with her when the National Center for History in the Schools was first established at UCLA through an NEH grant administered by Lynn Cheney. So the idea was there'd be a historian and person from the School of Education who had worked together on this center to try and lift the level of historical literacy in the schools. And then when we got the job of coordinating the writing of history standards, we were co-chairs of that, so we were working in tandem. We were yoked together in this project from, the standards are not from hell, but the project might have been from hell in terms of the sweat, blood, and tears involved in trying to create it over a three-year period.
Okay, well, if you want to get into the details of that, it's all in History on Trial. If you could sort of sum up what you finally came up with and it was hundreds of pages, but the gist of it, what was the thrust, the approach that you tried to convey in it?
The idea was to distill, both in world history and U.S. history, what is most important for young children in this country, growing into teenagers, what is most important for them to study.
And again, there was a lot of focus on the process as well as the content.
That's right.
That they needed to look at it critically and consider it and see how it... And that was part of your vision of what a good citizen was.
Very much. Right. So these standards have two prongs, you might say.
Right.
One is the content
right.
side of it in world and U.S. history.
Right.
The other is the thinking skills involved.
Okay.
Just to memorize dates and places and names, that's not content. Only when you apply, analyze, cause and effect relationships, multiple perspectives, and all of the critical thinking skills we hope they'll carry out of history classes into life itself.
So even before the report was issued, there was apparently something of a reaction to it?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean. There were 2.5 years of hard work of creating national consensus. And so throughout that process, there was continual deliberation.
Right.
Voices from alternative sides on every issue were heard. And the struggle was on from day one to find common ground on what should be the content and what the thinking standards or the thinking skills ought to be.
This was something that was important to a lot of people and groups, wasn't
Absolutely.
It? Absolutely. Why was it important? Was it important for the same reason to all the groups or different reasons for different groups, do you think?
Well, I think anyone around the big table, when the cards were dealt, believed that history matters.
Right. So in a sense, whatever happens in this, this is all kind of a endorsement of the importance of history. By everyone of every ideological stripe.
Oh, yes. That was certainly bound us all together.
People shared that. George Orwell wrote in 1984, he who controls the present controls the past, he who controls the past controls the future. And I think everyone there was sort of working on that basis.
The big difference between the consensus-building process, which was just ripe with controversy
right.
in meeting after meeting,
right.
was that all of the parties at the table were really struggling to find a resolution of the problem.
Okay.
When the standards hit the fan with
right.
Lynn Cheney's assault in the
right.
Wall Street Journal, we had critics who were not eager to find consensus. It became
right.
a political battle in which the goal was to tear down the standards, not to work for improving them. And so you had two very different kinds of climates of opinion that were going on at the...
Is it ironic or obvious that the person who set the process in motion became its most vociferous critic?
Well, I think there's a good deal of irony there. We repeat in the book History on Trial a one-sentence letter from Lynn Cheney just before she left office as chair of NEH. It's a Dear Charlotte letter. I'm telling everyone in Washington what a great job you're doing on the history standards.
Right.
And she had already seen a good bit of them.
Right.
Yet, a few months later, she calls them the standards from hell. The Wall Street Journal article had the title, The End of History.
Did someone get to her? Did she change her agenda? What happened?
Yes. The political climate had shifted to the right. Remember that just after her Wall Street Journal article, the 104th Congress would be elected. The Republicans would have both houses for the first time in half a century.
That's the Contract with America Congress.
That Contract with America Congress.
Right.
And yes, I do believe that someone's gotten with Lynn Cheney.
You think she was angling for a nice job?
We're not in the business of guessing what her motivations
were.
She
did get the job, though, as a guest host on Crossfire.
Yeah. Well, she's stayed before the public a good deal since then.
Okay.
But Charlotte's right. We're not guessing about her motives.
Right.
But there was, and I do think the political shift that occurred at that time, buttressed by a very strong agenda from the Christian Coalition
right.
to defund the Department of Education, bring all of its programs out of Washington, return them to local control, to defund the National Endowment for the Humanities, and there really was nothing to attack the National Endowment for the Humanities with, equivalent to the Mapplethorpe uproar with the National Endowment for the Arts.
So they had to take what they could get.
And
this is what they had.
This, we have many, many quotes in this book of people who assume this may have been part of the problem.
Well, when you mention the Christian Coalition, it brings to mind the fact that it's not only history where this issue and these players are joining a battle, is it, in terms of what should be taught in the schools and what the schools should be doing?
The Christian Coalition has not been friendly to the inquiry-based education, that is, asking young people to read and then think carefully about what they've read and imagine how there could be a different interpretation.
Are there more, would you say, to read it and believe it? Kind of
read it and believe it. Yes, indeed.
But the it is the critical thing.
Well,
see, if you look at the uproar that went on in the state of Virginia following the release of the national standards,
right,
where the governor appointed a small committee who represented the Christian Coalition of the state, the homeschooling movement of the state,
right,
and conservative Republicans in the state, and a very small committee, they produced a framework that just set the state afire. The superintendents of the local school districts, the teachers, the parent-teacher association, were just outraged, and the Republicans, moderates in the state legislature, called for a dismissal of that group and a rescinding of the product they had created and the development of a new framework of standards and a new committee to do it. So you had that same battle raised there, except it started from a product that was memorize the facts and its orientation, that was very limited in the depth of history that would be incorporated, and that was absolutely oblivious to the fact that this nation has included what we call minorities now in California. They're fast becoming the majority population, but African Americans and other people of minority parentage. That history was just not
in terms of process.
Important.
In terms of process, this seems very much to me to be an extension into the educational realm of biblical inerrancy, that this is the truth, learn it, and obey.
Well, in the book, we do talk about how an earlier textbook writer, Harold Rugg, was
right,
attacked in the 1930s.
Yes, let's read along together on that one.
Well, here was a person, and we hear echoes from the past that come forward to today's controversy over the history standards. She complained that historians were, quote, trying to give a child an unbiased viewpoint instead of teaching him real Americanism. All the old histories taught my country right or wrong. That's the point of view we want our children to adopt. We can't afford to teach them to be unbiased and let them make up their own minds.
I think that sums it up. In fact, I've included that very quote in the printed material that's going to accompany this interview on the Internet, because I thought that pretty much epitomized and summed up the entire controversy.
And it's interesting that that is the nub of the criticism that arises time and time again throughout the 20th century.
Okay, we've got a minute or two left. Not just in the United States, this is very transnational. There's a quote you have about the superiority of the Aryan race in making history, which Goebbels would have been very happy with, I'm sure, and it was a textbook in the U.S. in 1874. So
one of the joys of putting this book together, with Ross Dunn's wonderful help — Ross Dunn had much to do with the coordination of the World History Standards — is he was able to bring the international perspective in.
Right.
And also to help us examine why we had such a war over Western civilization,
right,
versus world history, as though Western history was not a part of the world, which of course it is, and the Western story is very strong in our standards. But for those who were offended by that, they were offended by the fact that it wasn't exclusively Western.
Right.
As though the students growing up today shouldn't know anything about China, shouldn't know anything about Latin America.
As I was reading about that, I recalled the non-Westerner Mahatma Gandhi, who was asked what he thought of Western civilization. He said he thought it would be a good idea. So. The last issue I think I want us to cover here has to do with actually two more points. What is the status of these standards now, and how implemented are they becoming, and how's that going?
Well, the standards were to be voluntary. The same was true in science or math or civics or geography standards. And they have been looked at by thousands of people, curriculum writers, individual teachers who have them on their desk, school boards, state boards of education. They've been looked at as a resource, not as a Bible, as a source of new ideas rather than a template. So while the states have busily constructed their history standards, you can see the fingerprints of the national history standards on their take on what kids should learn about history, let's say in Wisconsin or Mississippi. So they are having an effect, I think.
Okay.
But they're not a Bible.
It's this effect that I want to deal with in our last few minutes here. You especially, and all the other people in the book, and people who were in this dispute, all believed that what was taught in that what is taught in schools is extremely important in shaping the citizens of the future, and therefore fought mightily to see that their particular perspective was ascendant in the,
yeah,
in the discussion. I don't see a lot of talk about history, and in the world on television and the radio, except on PBS and here on our show, and I don't even always see decision makers, public decision, politicians, and business leaders, and so on, relying on historical analogies or data or precedents or insights in their decision making.
Well, in the first part of that, I would disagree.
Okay.
I think if you look at the way people pour to the Civil War battlefields and
right,
watch these historical enactors
right,
recreate the Civil War, you go to England and they're doing the medieval period with reenactors.
Right.
And historical societies and history exhibitions, whether
right,
you go to the Chicago Historical Society or one in a very small town,
right,
they're thronged with people as they never have been before. So I see, on the one hand, I see a lot of public interest. And I put that as a credit to the way we've opened history up and reached out to all of the American people in historical society presentations, or in the way historic sites talk not just about the few but the many. So I think history is more accessible to different kinds of Americans.
Do you think it's changing the way people think and act politically?
That's the second part of your question, and there I'm less inclined to argue with you on that.
Right. Because it doesn't seem... I've been active politically for, if you stretch the definition, almost about 35 years. And I don't think I've ever seen a time when people were more apolitical, cared less about politics, were more cynical about it when they bothered to think about it, and were reluctant to get involved in it in any level, and instead concentrate on their work, their family, and their consumption. And there are historical messages in that, but I don't see anyone getting them or acting on them.
Well, I agree. The stories coming out of these small towns to which urban people are pouring to work at home,
right,
all are about the same. I want to be left alone and make a lot of money.
Right, mm-hmm, right. And so it may be that they are learning a lot from history, which is that it's a nightmare from which they are trying to either awake or exit, and therefore are acting on that basis. But I would like to believe, and I try to do what you're advocating implicitly and explicitly, that history be a guide for present and future behavior. But I don't see it happening, and I see it becoming less important, so that while the struggles in your book, History on Trial, are very... interesting and useful to understand the dynamic of that particular political and social struggle, the end result is that children spend 1 hour a day maybe learning critical thinking skills from historical events, and then watch 6 hours of television that bombard them with images of consumption and instant gratification.
But this will change.
Oh, how? When?
Because all historians at one level or another believe that in cycles, not perfect symmetrical cycles,
right,
but that things do change and that the wheel keeps turning.
Right.
And we are going through a period of me-ism,
right,
and rampant narcissism.
Right.
But we have been through such periods before, and it won't be that way forever. And if history instruction in the schools is a lot better, hopefully kids will pack away in those brain cells some of it which they did find interesting. Maybe it'll kick in again at some point down the line.
I'm seeing teachers when people examine this issue and how it was going on in the 90s, they can turn to History on Trial by our two guests to get an idea about how this important issue was being dealt with in what now seems like the present, but will later be past and will later be history. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mark.